Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, according to the time and place you listen to us at this particular moment. My name is Armando Conte, and this is SOAS Radio. My guest today is Professor Peter Austin, linguist. Professor Austin, it is generally agreed that today there are about 6,500 spoken languages in the world, but there are a couple of hundreds of them disappearing. Can you please enlighten us? The main reason for language death or language endangerment?
Yeah, sure. The figures are actually worse than you even suggested just now. There's, as you said, about 6,500 or so languages spoken today. About half of them, at least half of them, are under threat and are likely to no longer be spoken by the end of this century. So by the end of the 21st century, 3,000 or so languages will have disappeared. And the major reason is that communities are shifting to speaking the languages not of their tradition, not of their history, not their heritage, but to speak the language of much more powerful neighbors, languages that have economic, social, cultural power. Parents will often decide there's no point speaking our language. There's only a few thousand speakers of it. It would be much better for our children to learn a big language like Swahili or Yoruba or Hausa, and therefore they start speaking that to their children, and the children grow up dominant in that language and not knowing the language of their parents and grandparents. This process is called language shift, where we're shifting from one language to another, and it's happening all over the place, all over the world. In the case of Africa, it tends to be the major dominant regional languages, which are the ones that are having the impact, not the international languages like French or Portuguese or English. People are not necessarily speaking that to their kids, but rather they're shifting to big languages like Maninka or Hausa or Swahili or whatever the local dominant languages are.
How about the financial or the economical reasons of language endangerment?
Well, very often parents think, well, you know, our kids would have a better chance to get a job, to move to the city, to, you know, find work, to get an education if they speak one of the languages, a bigger language of wider communication. So that's often the impetus for this kind of language shift to take place. In the past, when people did move and they, you know, went to look for work or to move to other communities, they would learn a second or third or fourth language and become multilingual. But frequently what's happening now is that they're not adding languages, but they're replacing them. So they're instead of adding on Swahili or adding on Hausa, they're actually giving up their own language and switching to the dominant one.
And how can we balance that necessity of the new generation to go to the big cities for financial reasons with the need of observing or at least to preserve the language from dying or from language being disappearing?
Yeah, well, I think it's really up to communities and individuals to decide what they think is the way that they want to go. Some communities will feel that the loss of the language is something that's a tragedy, that's something that they would not like to happen, that they would like to continue their children to preserve and maintain the language of their ancestors, of their grandparents, and so on. Other communities are not quite so worried about that, and so they don't see the significance of maintaining the traditional languages. They have a more flexible attitude, perhaps we could say. And some groups want to maintain the language, but at the same time adding on the languages of wider communication, the more powerful ones. So this is really these are really decisions to be made by the individuals and the communities themselves. And if they decide they want to maintain the languages, then what we often need to do then is to document them, to make recordings, to develop writing systems, because most of the languages of the world have never been written down. So we need to develop orthographies and writing systems and, you know, dictionaries and teaching materials. That's very demanding, of course, and requires a lot of time and effort and energy. So one of the things that we're doing here is trying to train people from all over the world. We have students attending here from everywhere, from Senegal and Ethiopia and different places, to training them in the methods and techniques to do this sort of work so that hopefully we can have a whole new generation who are trained to support and develop languages where communities decide that they want to do something about it.
Saturday 14th was the last day of Endangerment Language Project seminars and workshop. How did the event contribute for the prevention of language endangerment?
Well, the main reason that we run this, it's a public, it's public access, it's open to everybody, and we've been running it every year for the last 4 years, is really to raise awareness about the issues. Many people here in London are just simply not aware of the fact that there are lots and lots of languages around and that many of them are under threat and pressure. So we want to help the broader community here in the City of London and also internationally to understand and appreciate the loss of linguistic diversity, the speed at which this is happening, and the fact that there are communities who are struggling with issues of language and cultural maintenance. One of the interesting projects as part of this was actually a student-led project. The students thought it up and put it together themselves, and that was to identify what languages are spoken first at SOAS, but also more broadly within London. And they found all sorts of amazing, hundreds of languages that people who just come to SOAS speak. And also really interesting things like a primary school education that's being done here in London in a language called Basque, which is spoken in Spain and southern France. There's a kindergarten running here in London for Maori, which is the language of the indigenous people of New Zealand. Aotearoa, as it's called in Maori. So the communities who are living here in this enormous big city are trying as hard as they can to maintain their languages and their cultures so that when the children, for example, go back to their home country, they can talk to their grandparents in their own language and they can participate in the language and culture.
But that's very, very difficult to maintain, isn't it? Because of English being, a dominant language in the world, it's very, very difficult to maintain these dialects and the languages, isn't it?
It is. It takes a lot of effort and energy, and the communities have to be really committed to do that. But, I mean, part of the reason we run these events, public events, is to raise awareness. You know, people say, in England everybody speaks English. Well, that's not true. The City of London, there's something like 400 different languages that are spoken here in this city. And, anywhere you travel, if you get on a bus or on the tube, you'll hear people speaking all sorts of languages. So communities are trying to maintain them and trying to keep them going. And they're confronted with the sort of political message, the monolingual English message, which is simply wrong. It's not the case that England is monolingual. England is multilingual, multicultural. Places like London, just show that. And so I think if we can sort of make people aware of that diversity and that helps them in the sense of, the broader community can then say, yeah, well, we understand you are working very hard to keep your language and your culture alongside, of course, English, because they need English as the wider communication language, to that their kids can grow up being bilingual or multilingual.
As a linguist, are you optimist regarding the language endangerment, or at least if we could stop language disappearing?
Yeah. I think it's a really mixed scenario. It's a mixed situation. Mm-hmm. There are some languages that, unfortunately, are going to disappear. Mm-hmm. The communities who speak them are not in a position to be able, are not in a position because of the lack of resources, the lack of energy, the lack of skills, the lack of economic power to be able to maintain them. And those languages will simply disappear from the earth. That's one sort of group that are going to end up like that. But there are also other communities and other groups who have said, no, we're going to fight back against this kind of thing. I mean, the Maori in New Zealand is a typical case of this. The local Maori community decided, we want to support and maintain our language. And they started a system of what they call language nests, where grandparents and little kids are brought together in daycare and the instruction to the grandparents is only speak Māori to these children. And now we have a whole generation of kids who've grown up through that system, and you can study, you can do your studies in New Zealand in Māori at university, at high school, at primary school. That's one case where, you know, an indigenous minority community have in a way fought back against the kind of tide of language shift. The Hawaiians have done similar things. There are similar things happening in Mexico and other places around the world. But overall, probably we're going to see many more languages disappearing than will be able to be supported and preserved.
You gave two examples of Maoris in London and Basque, you know, kindergartens. Do you think Africans, in this case, Africans can also, what can they do in order to preserve the diversity of their languages or dialects, if you prefer, here in London, for example?
Well, I actually see, I live in Hackney, and I actually see the preservation of African languages pretty much. Every time I catch the bus to come to work, I hear people speaking Yoruba and so on. So, I mean, that's mostly amongst adults. The issue is the children. How do you keep it going for the children? And it's difficult. It requires a lot of hard work and requires things like linking up with education, possibly having kids go to school on Saturdays to, you know, study their own languages and so on. Although there's lots of opportunities now with particularly using the internet, you know, Skype, being able to call back to the home country. You know, one of my students is from Ghana, and, you know, she's regularly in contact with her family back in Ghana. If she had kids here, then they could be talking to the grandparents in, you know, and the grandparents don't speak English. The grandparents only speak the Akan variety of Tri. And so growing up here, they would have opportunities through things like internet communications, through Skype, mobile phones, to be able to communicate with the family back home. So it has to be a kind of combination of individual activity by individuals to speak the language to their children, to have opportunities for the language to be used by the kids, but also combined perhaps with community-based festivals, activities, education, doing some stuff in the classroom, you know, putting on events where people have the opportunity to practice the language and practice their culture.
And finally, I'm dying to ask you this question. We believe, as you said, sometimes, you know, lack of technology, lack of resources. Now, think about the language called Esperanto. You know, it was invented. If you could please, you know, tell us why Esperanto didn't succeed.
Well, Esperanto was invented by Dr. Zamenhof as what he saw as being a solution to all the sort of conflict between people speaking different languages. And his idea was that it was meant to be a neutral language, that it was developed in Poland. He was Polish, and so he wanted to have a sort of neutral language that would allow Poles and Russians and Germans and, you know, French people and so on to talk to one another. So why didn't it succeed? I mean, there is a big community of people who support it. There's thousands of people who've been studying Esperanto, and they have international conferences every year, and they translate books into Esperanto and so on. So there's a very enthusiastic community of people, but it hasn't been more broadly successful because basically it's nobody's language. Nobody associates themselves as being their primary language. And he always saw it as what he called an auxiliary language, a kind of second, you know, additional language just for communication. So I guess that whole thing about, you know, nobody owns it, nobody really associates themselves with it. The second factor is that although he saw it as an international language, it's very European in terms of the way it's organized, its grammatical structure, its vocabulary. It's as difficult for somebody from Japan or China to learn Esperanto as it is for them to learn English or French or German, right? So it's difficult because all the words, the basic words and basic roots are European ones. They come from all sorts of European languages, but they're European. then if you're a speaker of Chinese, why would you bother learning Esperanto when you can learn English with 500 million speakers, or learn German with 100 million speakers, or French with 100 million speakers, and so on? So you have to invest almost the same amount of time and energy to learn Esperanto, but the benefit is much smaller because you haven't got as many people to talk to in it. So because it's not neutral, he kind of thought it was a neutral language, but it's not neutral. It's a European language, and people have to learn it in the same way they have to learn foreign languages. So there's really no benefit to somebody outside of Europe, not as much benefit anyway to somebody outside Europe, to learn Esperanto, because it is, you get more benefit from learning these bigger languages.
Professor Peter Austin, thank you very much for coming to Africa Beat.
You're welcome.